And we are back with episode 425 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville. And is that a siren I hear? Oh no, it faded out.
And here in the center ring, here I am, Gary from Jacksonville.
And we are going to have lots to talk about in this particular episode, so let's go ahead and just jump right in with the usual disclaimer. Go ahead. Go for it, Edmund.
We will talk about just about anything that happened in these episodes, including something I might have just let out of the bag already. We just want to let you know that, and we've tried to wait a week before we do that, so you won't be too horribly spoiled.
That's right. And, well... I believe, Gary, it is your turn to pick the next topic here, so have at it.
Yes, I'm going to go with a show that's made it to the big leagues. Grimm.
Very good. And here's the promo.
Next Friday. Is this some kind of Vesson carnival?
The circus is in town.
I'm going to make you a star.
And all hell...
I don't think that's part of the show.
...is about to break loose.
I'll take it from here.
And in the coming weeks...
Where are you taking me?
Mom's back.
I need your help.
With the last person they'll expect.
Oh, my God.
NBC's Grimm. All new, next Friday, 9, 8 Central. Stream past seasons of Grimm exclusively on Amazon Prime Instant Video.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Absolutely. We're talking about Grimm, Season 3, Episode 16. The show must go on. Monroe and Rosalie go undercover at a traveling carnival that's linked to a double homicide. Meanwhile, Monroe asks Nick an important question pertaining to his upcoming nuptials, and a member of the Resistance goes all in to help Adeline.
All right. And what would you give this one?
I am going to give this one a 7.
Okay, and I'm going to give it a 6. This was my least favorite episode of the season so far. Where do I even start? Basically, my problem with this episode was that I felt like the whole premise at the carnival was a little cliche, and I just felt like there were so many things about this whole situation that could have been resolved a lot more easily. I felt like there were a lot of holes in the story, so to speak, and I'm not explaining it particularly well, but I thought the whole idea of... You know, the Vesson carnival in the first place, just, it didn't quite make sense that you've got this carnival where they're displaying their true nature to people openly. And
well, John, I know it's not the cape, but we all have to get over that and just try and make the best of
it. I know. But it does seem like this would have gone against the council a long time ago. So I just, especially with one of the Vesson being... kind of running the whole thing, so it just didn't really connect for me. But how about you, Gary? You seem to feel it was a little bit better than I did, so...
Well, I admit the Wesson carnival is a little bit hokey, but at the same time, I can sort of see it, at least for the was it the Blue Bloods and some of the less scarier creatures that did this. You know, we didn't have, like, the Adeline Hexen Beast showing up here. They were a little bit more friendly, I guess, if you'd have to pick that term for them. But we also, you know, we got some other things in here. As Monroe was talking about this and giving us the history, how, yes, the council accepts this open use of them transforming or woging, I guess.
Voguing, yeah.
Voguing, but they don't encourage it, and they sort of, you know, distract it. I guess I tried to equate it with, Indians doing an Indian show for a tourist attraction. Yes, they sort of, you know, understand its culture, but they really don't want them to keep doing it. It's kind of exploitive. So I can see their point, and I thought they handled it well. And also, we got the nice little tidbit that if Wesson transformed too much, their beast side sort of starts to take control, which was a nice little tidbit of information that we hadn't had before. So I wonder if they'll use that at some point in the future. Maybe somebody's forced to change a lot or something like that. So I found that interesting. And also, Woo's back on the job.
Yes.
That was sort of nice, but at the same time, I feel like it's a ticking time bomb just waiting to explode, and I'm waiting for – I keep – okay, is he going to see something again? Or, you know, when's he going to, you know, totally snap and lose it or something like that? So while I'm glad to see Wu back, I'm still kind of worried that he's back. So
yeah.
But that was still good. And then the whole Adeline thing, it seems to be dragging out a little too much for me at this point. The chase has been going on for 6, 7, 8 million episodes now, and I wish that she would get somewhere.
Yeah, there seems to always be that one plot line every season so far that just takes the entire season to play out, and it always feels like it's dragging along. And Adeline and her child is kind of the obvious example here. Of course, to a certain extent, I kind of understand that since it's critical to this whole Royals versus Resistance storyline that they need other things to happen first, but okay, then maybe spend less time on some of these side stories and just get on with it, because, you know, at any rate. A little bit of a, probably, like I said, my least favorite of the season. I just felt like the whole carnival thing was just overdone. I've seen enough of that sort of thing before. I mean, you did mention the cape, which, I mean, that's bringing back another example of how it doesn't necessarily play out very well. I would have even invoked the final season of Heroes, where it was kind of just... it's an overused genre staple at this point.
I want to catch you with that. Is it overused, or are we just really getting disconnected from it? You know, for a long time, carnivals, circuses were probably a main source of entertainment for people. Are we just so far from it now that it just doesn't resonate anymore?
I think that it's the use of the carnival as some kind of haven for misfits of society or whatever else. It's just when you see the carnival come into a story, you almost already know how it's going to play out. It's never really a new take on it, I guess you could say. Because I don't know, I mean, right now, if you were to have sideshows like that, very often it's like, you know, extreme body modification and all these kinds of things that you know, like the Jim Rose type of show, I think that's the name of the guy, right? That goes to like Lollapalooza and they have all the really extreme stuff going on there. But very often in episodes like this, for instance, it seems to play on this very traditional sideshow type of atmosphere where it's, you know, the mutated or, you know, hiding behind, you know, hiding in plain sight type of thing. And it, I don't know, it just feels like a trope more than a shift where it just doesn't resonate anymore. But that's just me. But that's it for Grim, as far as I'm concerned. Anything else that you wanted to bring up on this? Or, hey, I brought it up because, hey,
no, I
think more than one of us is watching it right now. So there you go. Okay, then.
I enjoy the show.
Once again, excuse the wonderful lagging that we keep getting here on Google. Seems like they wanted to catch up and be the new Skype, but anyhow, Edmund, how about you? What would you say is your next or your first choice for this show anyway?
Let us talk about stay in the weird supernaturally vein and talk about Lost Girl.
Okay, and here's the promo.
There's no escape, Sakura.
Sunday on Showcase.
Give us the Unamen seed or die.
The sixth Unamen seed. Someone's taken it from me.
When an ancient power goes missing.
Whoever has that seed has no idea what kind of power it can unleash.
Loyalties are questioned.
We were always more than just lovers.
And what are we now?
And lives.
Will you marry me?
Will be forever changed.
You can't always choose your path.
Lost Girl. New episode Sunday at 10. Exclusively on Showcase, where character is everything.
And if you could do the recap, please.
This is Lost Girl, Season 3, Episode 11, End of a Line. The team put their energy into finding out who sent a Fae to attack Bo. At the same time, Bo's feelings for someone she loves begins to waver, and Kenzie gets a surprise visit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what would you give this one, do you think?
I will give this one an 8.
Okay. And how about you, Gary?
Well, on a quality level, I suppose I'll give it an 8, but on a dissatisfaction scale, I would drop it. I was not happy with this episode at all. I even yelled out at one point. So,
yeah, I would have to probably give it an 8 as well. But Gary, why don't you go ahead and follow up on that a little bit?
Oh, poor Hal! No.
I know.
Oh, God. They were just getting happy, and maybe I should have known then. But
yeah.
That's
I thought maybe it could work out that, you know, Dyson could have all the romantic problems. They could have a stable couple. Oh, jeez.
And they did for about 15 minutes.
And wasn't it lovely? Wasn't it just... I just didn't expect that coming. And then to find out that, the seeds of this had been plotted a long time ago, as far as this season goes, and that Kenzie giving up that little piece of twig was what did Hale in, really, to all intents and purposes. So she feels horrible. We feel horrible. Could we just finish the episode now? Because it was... I didn't see that coming. I've enjoyed the character. I love how, I'll miss him. I really enjoy Hale and Dyson better than I do Tasman and Dyson. So I'm a little disappointed. Who knows? They could bring him back somehow, I suppose, in this show. So I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Interesting. Okay. And Edmund, how about you? I mean, why would you give it an 8, do you think?
Yeah, the odd thing was, I thought in terms of it basically got an 8 on the strength of the certain guest stars and the relationships that we built up over this season. And certainly, yes, of course, Hale's demise was a huge sort of a sucker punch at the end there, because this is a case of the actual story that they are pursuing. I was not finding all that compelling, having Linda Hamilton back and having her and Beau jousting with each other and actually getting into that little cat fight, and Trick and Vex having their little moment back at the doll, was the things that really wound up putting it above average. And it seemed like, especially for an episode that's, we're not, after dealing with all those penultimate episodes last show, this is not quite penultimate, but it's next to the penultimate. It felt like it wasn't doing that much to actually push the season arc forward, but there were all these both wonderful moments with the characters we've gotten to know, and then this moment that was beautifully done, but horribly tragic. I mean, both with Hale's demise, and then Beau coming back, and Kenzie begging her to bring him back, and her not being able to was just heartbreaking. And as Gary said, the fact that it was all set up so long ago, and even bringing back last season's finale with, no, but you brought Dyson back, and now she can't do the same for Hale, was just heartrending.
Yeah, I definitely feel like they had set this up a while ago, and they knew that they were going to do this, and they did a nice job of letting the relationship kind of build, and then hitting this up the way that they did. I guess the only thing that kept this from really being a 9 for me was the fact that once again we have a situation where I know that they did introduce the character that wound up kind of being the hitman, I guess, in this particular episode. I know that they've done that that he was introduced before, but it still felt a little bit like, because we haven't seen him in a while, that it felt out of nowhere, maybe out of left field a little bit. But I can appreciate the fact that they put all these little pieces in place and everything, but I still feel like the plotting this season has been very haphazard. And as much as I like this episode bringing things together, I still feel as though some of the connective tissue was not there. And from what I understand, there's other places where some of this stuff has been covered. But to my mind, that reminds me a little bit of that Heroes problem, to invoke that show again, where they would put stuff in the ancillary material on the website instead of putting it in the show and then assume that people knew about it. So, yeah, it wasn't nearly as egregious as other episodes have been, but it did feel like, okay, who is this guy again? Why didn't we at least name check the guy previously? What's the deal with that? But as far as impact goes, there's no question that this was a gut punch of an episode. And it just goes to show that when Lost Girl wants to hit you right between the eyes, they're going to. I would have really liked to have heard Bronstone's description of this. This would have been his kick to the heart crotch type of thing again. But
oh gosh,
yeah, it was rough.
Yeah, no, I mean, I do see what they were going for in terms of the way his death at the beginning of the season into that that molten pit was certainly looked extremely definitive. And they did, and I agree with you that it would have been nice to have, I think, the way it played out, having it come up a little bit prior to this, because they had it at the beginning of the episode when Linda Hamilton shows up and says, you know, oh yeah, Massimo put my hand back, and you just have to assume it was before he fell into the pit. But if there had been a couple of little mentions of him previously where you could start laying that seed of, well, oh, wait a minute, was this before or after he was gone? I do think that might have worked a little bit better. Even though, I mean, when it happened, I did completely buy that. Okay, guys, you did set this all up, and especially when he brought out the twig. But there was that split second of oh right, okay, yeah, now I remember that. I think they could have set up the rather than having it just come completely out of the blue, set up a little bit of uncertainty about it beforehand.
Yeah, I guess the fact that even name-dropping him at the beginning of the episode still wasn't enough for me to even remember who he was. Because they've just had such a thing of just dropping stuff in with no explanation or preamble that I didn't make the connection. It wasn't until I actually saw the guy on the screen and then was like, oh, wait, I have seen him before, haven't I? But anything else to say about this one other than the fact that it is a bit of a game changer, isn't it? I mean, certainly this is going to propel them into the end of the season.
Oh yeah. No, well, no, I mean, also in terms of the way they were, just the setup for Hale going, we haven't mentioned Kenzie's family coming back, and that just added to the whole buildup to the gut punch was discovering that yes, they're back and they're a lot of fun. And discovering that yes, it was Hale who set all this up because he was preparing to propose. And of course they were playing him because that's what Kenzie's family does. It was another of those cases where it was just the other example in this episode where it felt like, you know, now you're bringing together all of these wonderful scenes with all these characters we like. And, but that was the one instance where, it really was leading somewhere, where with some of the other stuff that was going on in the episode, it was like, no, that's nice stuff that's going on the periphery of the story that I'm not that invested in. But that certainly was the contributing factor to it then being so devastating at the end that you saw Hale really making this effort and at the same time getting this taste of, yes, okay, now I see why Kenzie doesn't want to hang out with these people anymore.
Let's see. Anything more to say then about this episode? No? Okay. Well, then let me just check the time real quick on this one. And I think we're going to go ahead and take our mid-show break, and then we'll be right back with Gary's Next Choice. So stay tuned. All right, and Gary, what would you like to discuss next?
Well, I missed it this week, but I'd love to hear you talk about Vikings.
Okay, well, we can definitely do that. Well, let's go ahead and run the promo.
Your lands are lost, invaded by Jarl Borg.
I am your new ruler.
Thursday on an all-new Vikings.
There will be no protest against my rule. There will be no law here except mine.
Now Jarl Borg lives in your great hall and rules in your place.
To all intents and purposes, Ragnar Lothbrok is dead.
It'll be winter soon enough. If we have nowhere to live, we will all perish.
Believe me, you and I can survive this. It'll make you stronger.
Your family has fled.
Prepare the ships!
You're leaving?
Of course I am. I must find my family.
They expressed a desire to talk.
How are we to trust men like these?
Now we are equal. We can talk together honestly. I am an ambitious man. I have great plans, and you could help me to fulfill them.
Ragnar Lothbrok, his vanity will kill him.
No, not his vanity.
I will kill him!
Well, this is Vikings, Season 2, Episode 4, Eye for an Eye. Lagertha and Ragnar unite to battle Jarl Borg. Later, Bjorn makes a difficult choice, which means absolutely nothing if you haven't actually seen the episode, or have seen the show. Yeah, I put this on the list mainly to see if you had actually watched it, and then discuss as more than just a quick hit. But regardless, I will once again give this an 8. And what I will say about this one is that they're doing a really nice job of playing things out over the course of the season. And, you know, for a little while, you know, Ragnar and his first wife, Lagertha, were split apart because he went and wound up impregnating another woman and marrying her and made the very foolish assumption that, yeah, we could all be one happy family, right? No. One thing that I love is that in the first season, Lagertha was one of those really surprising female characters that she was extremely strong and if not a match for the men, sometimes even more powerful than the men in terms of her presence. And that has only exponentially increased in this second season. They are really making her out to be, you know, more than just a shield maiden in name, that's for sure. She can stand her ground like anyone's business. And they've actually done a really nice job of incorporating women into the combat more and more in the second season. I don't know if they were intentionally holding back a little bit on that in the first season and only doing it now and then, but they've really been showing how, you know, adults in general were trained to fight, not just the men. That's for sure. But, you know, when she came riding in to help Ragnar kind of gather the forces to take it to Jarl Borg for invading in the previous episode, it's one of the better moments of the season so far because you just, you know, want to throw up a cheer because, you know, she gets even more prominent time on screen and it doesn't hurt that she's freaking gorgeous. But she's fierce, and you just know that it's also going to cause a lot of great drama being in the same presence as her rival, so to speak. And of course, now Bjorn comes back as a much older character, and, you know, he's got to decide what is he going to do. Is he going to fight or not? And he really wants to show his father where he stands. So, yeah, it was a good episode. It really got things moving. But also, we had some action back in England, in Wessex, and things go very badly for the ex-priest. I'll just put it that way. He gets to experience a little bit of torture, and perhaps very fitting and thematically fitting torture, shall we say. So his spiritual conflict, internal conflict, is not going to be resolved anytime soon. So it's just taken on different dimensions. But I give this one an 8, like I said, and certainly anybody who loves these period dramas, these historical dramas, this show is really off to a great start for the second season, and it's already been renewed for a third season. So, yay! Go Vikings!
Yeah. Although the tennis fan in me does just have to ask, Bjorn is not Jarl's brother by any chance, is he?
No. No. Sorry. Okay. Bjorn is Ragnar's son, not Jarl Borg. Okay. okay. In any way related. Sorry. Let's see. Edmund, but since you chose to start, why don't you go ahead and give us our next topic?
I'm thinking, why don't we delve into the quick hits?
We can do that. So why don't we go ahead and get started with The Vampire Diaries, Season 5, Episode 16, While You Were Sleeping. Damon tries to find the right way to make a disturbing confession to Elena. Caroline discovers a scary secret in Dr. Wes's files. Enzo claims to have a solution everyone is searching for. Sloane reveals new information on the importance of doppelgangers. And, well, I'll just be very short on this one and say that I gave this one a 7 out of 10. It was kind of slow after all of the Catherine material that they were really heavily discussing and going through, and well, what can I say? It just I think they need to get the ball rolling again after losing such an important character. But let's see. Next, Edmund, I think you need to take this one.
Yes, this is Hannibal, Season 2, Episode 4, Takiawase. Beverly works on a mural killer case. Well, it's actually just one mural killer case, but anyway. And secretly consults Will, whose suspicions rise about Hannibal. Elsewhere, a body is found in a meadow. And that doesn't even cover 10% of what went on in this episode, but which I would give an 8. The main reason for that was the killer of the week in this one was a little weak, not quite up to their standards. But what was going on around it was up to the usual high standards. I will save the big revelation to the end, but certainly the whole storyline with Jack Crawford's wife being having cancer, contemplating suicide, her showing up at Hannibal's office, having taken the morphine, was just an extraordinary scene of having Gina Torres and Mads Mikkelsen playing that out with the setup there's been in the previous episodes was just marvelous. And then Hannibal literally deciding her fate on a coin toss, so that he did revive her and bring her back so that Jack could actually say goodbye against her wishes, was marvelously done, and Hannibal also fully deserved the slap that that he got at the end because of that. Then of course the huge thing that happens at the end of this episode where Will has been carefully working on Beverly to investigate the past killings and try to find the connections between the copycat and the Chesapeake Ripper, which he of course does, and the tragic misstep that because she doesn't want to tell anybody that she is actually going to investigate Hannibal Lecter, she winds up at Hannibal Lecter's basement, and exactly what you expect to happen happens. So Will's got a whole new pile of guilt to deal with, not to mention another body. So, it was... In terms of all the ongoing stuff, it was very, very strong, and just the beeswax person just didn't quite live up to all the ongoing story that they've set up.
Mm. Okay. I'll take the next one. Bitten, Season 1, Episode 11, Settling. Elena enters into damage control mode with Philip, who has become painfully aware of her romantic history with Clay, and later breaks pack law when the mutts launch a coordinated attack in Toronto and threaten the human she loves. Oh, that's... Putting it mildly, I think I've mentioned before that it seemed like it was inevitable that the people back in the quote-unquote real world that were linked to Elena and some of her packmates, that they would go into the line of fire sooner rather than later. And this is the episode where it all comes crashing down. And she basically has to reveal her true nature to her fiancé, or at least boyfriend, whatever you want to call it. And that is a big issue that this episode leaves on. So, this was nice because there was just a lot of bloodletting in this episode. It was pretty ugly by the end. But, I enjoyed it.
I must admit, the funny thing is because my DVR is set start early just to be safe. I have been catching the end of the final scenes of Bitten before being human, and this one was quite striking.
Yeah, I would say so. Why don't you go ahead and take the next one, Gary?
Absolutely. We're talking about The Good Wife. Season 5, Episode 15, Dramatics, Your Honor. Alicia enlists Carrie as her lawyer when she's deposed as part of the voter fraud investigation. Meanwhile, Will goes up against a new prosecutor who proves to be a formidable adversary in the Jeffrey Grant case. Henry and Nadim both are really like this episode a lot, with Henry giving it an 8 and Nadim giving it a 9. This has been a very strong series. It's not something we typically watch as part of our fare, but it's very popular, has a great following, and they're putting out quality material from what our reviewers say. So.
And this, of course, was a infamous episode of The Good Wife, yeah. Because this one was the shocking death of a main character.
Was this the one? I don't even follow the show, and I heard that. Yeah,
it was. And one of the things that came out afterwards was that Josh Charles, of course, plays Will, who was killed in this episode. Spoilers again, but if you haven't heard about it in the last week, then you probably didn't care anyway. But he wanted to leave at the end of last season, and they convinced him to stick around under the fact that they would give him a really big arc this season. And of course, what they've done with the huge breakup in the firm and the two firms warring against each other, and then, you know, his death very shockingly in this episode, was all very much linked to the fact that they knew he was going to leave, and so they pretty much were able to do whatever they wanted with him, because the character was going to go out in this very definitive way. So if anything, this is an example of a character, an actor wanting to leave a show and them really taking advantage of what they could do and the actor being more than up for it. So yeah, I'd say that really revitalized this season for a lot of people. My wife is loving this right now. She thinks this is, you know, her favorite show on TV at the moment. At any rate, there's a couple shows here that I don't think we can say that about. A bit of a list here. No. I'll go ahead and start here with Resurrection, Season 1, Episode 3, Two Rivers. Bellamy and Maggie look for clues in the local river as they continue to search for a connection between Caleb and Jacob. At the same time, Pastor Tom's life takes a dramatic turn, Caleb's criminal past comes to light, and Henry struggles to accept that his son has returned after 30 years. And I gave this one a 6 out of 10. Edmund, you're groaning in the background. Either that or you're a walker now. What was your thought on this one? Your score.
Yes, I might have been a walker after watching this episode. I'm tempted to drop it to a 5, actually.
Okay.
This series has just not been grabbing me. I just find myself just not having much interest in the in all these conflicts that they're trying to stoke up in the town, and these mysteries. And I think this is a case where the fact that after I watched the pilot, I did go back and start watching the French series, Les Revenants, where even though it is different source materials, it's so similar, and the way they dealt with it there just made so much more sense. And one of the things that's really getting to me is this whole 30-year time span just... I think really kills that whole storyline for me. This whole thing of people now in the latter stages of life meeting up with the son who still looks like he was when he died, just really isn't resonating. The whole thing with Caleb and the attacks and what he is. Yeah, I mean, when it comes down to it, I'm just not that interested in what they're trying to get me interested in.
Yeah, I think that I summed it up in two major problems with this show so far. As number one, as creepy as the main premise is, it's almost window dressing now to all these other conflicts. And yes, I understand that the conflicts are built in the fact that these people have returned and that they've now definitively shown that it's not a resurrection per se, but rather a kind of like rematerializing of some kind. It's you know, right down to the clothes that they were wearing in the casket, which is really bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't really
new one.
do anything with it. It's just there. And it's like, wow, you're putting so much into these personal conflicts that I really don't care about. I want to know what the heck's going on. And, you know, that I don't necessarily need the whole answer right away, but I do want to see some momentum with it. And it seems like it's very lackadaisical in terms of them trying to figure out why this is going on. And, you know, more and more people are coming back in this town. And I keep thinking to myself, is it just this town? What about the rest of the world? And if it's just this town, how is it staying only, like, the people in town knowing about it? I mean, something like that, I'm fairly sure would get out. I know it's the Midwest and all, but I'm pretty sure someone would say something on the internet or call somebody like the CDC or something, you know, and knowing our luck, they get the damn people from Helix. But it just seems very far-fetched to me that this was something that would be contained even for just over the course of a few days. This place should be like have media everywhere in this day and age, you know, especially since there are people that really don't like what's going on at all. I don't see them just being, you know, going around town and kind of, you know, stirring up problems just within town. I would expect that, oh, they have a real problem with this. Best way to get rid of it is to call the government. They'd come in and they'd take these people away and that's it. You know, they'd probably lock the town down for that matter. But anyway, that's my biggest problem is that it just doesn't seem to be, it finds the personal conflicts way more interesting than they are. I want to know more about what's causing this, or not even what's causing it, but what's the nature of it. Dig into that a little bit more. Escalate the scales. And then we also have, Edmund, if you don't mind taking the next one.
Absolutely. This is Believe, Season 1, Episode 3. The Origin. Bo and Tate get trapped in Manhattan and happen upon a wealthy woman mourning the loss of her son.
Yeah, just happened upon that, right? What did you give this?
I would give this a 6.
Okay, same here. And this is a slightly different problem, because I like the premise. I think that it has a lot of potential. Mm-hmm. The problem is it's repetitive as hell. 3 episodes, and it pretty much plays out the same way every time. And it's beginning to make the FBI look like a bunch of idiots. Because how many times are they going to get this much closer to actually taking Tate into custody? And then something happens.
Mm-hmm.
And
they get close to taking him into custody, and then Super Kid reveals another power.
That's right. Absolutely. And my favorite part is that Winter decides, oh, hey, you know what? I'm going to send you to Manhattan because I'm going to have you hide in plain sight in one of the most monitored cities on the planet. And there is a federal manhunt looking for you and the kid. Perfect idea.
I'm also particularly annoyed because making the FBI look stupid is making two of my favorite actors from Banshee look stupid.
Well, you know, the thought that I had in the back of my mind was that, okay, if you want to send them to New York and have them be anonymous, send them to, like, Brooklyn or Staten Island. Like, off the beaten
path. No, Brooklyn's hot now. Queens.
Okay, either one. It doesn't matter. Send them in the middle of, like, one of the boroughs that doesn't have security cameras on every single corner in every single cab car. Come on. But yeah,
the Bronx.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's plenty of places in the city that they could go that there'd be lots of room for safe houses. I don't know. The premise is there. The DNA is there, but the way it's playing out right now is that every episode is the same thing. You know how it's going to play out. Mm-hmm. So they're not giving the audience a reason to come back, and they've lost half their audience from the premiere. And the premiere had more than 10 million viewers.
Yeah.
So that's a huge loss. So I don't know how this is going to play out unless they really start to change things up. That and the origin story was only about half of an origin story, so maybe they might want to do a little more work with that. Let's see. Go ahead.
I just want to just quickly say, I know I was only a 6, but also that got to me as well, because the whole thing of like, oh yes, okay, so she died in childbirth, except of course her daughter thinks she's talking to her, so gee, when's she going to come back?
Yeah. Exactly. Let's see. We have next, Starcrossed. season one, oh episode gosh. Six, Stabbed with a White Wench's Black Eye. Great title for an episode, but Emery enlists Julia's help to distract a nosy photographer. Meanwhile, Drake plans to attend a charity ball thrown by Grayson's parents, and Roman's attempt to keep him out of trouble finds him caught up in a kidnapping scheme. Yeah, once again, whenever they get into the alien stuff, it's fun. Whenever they get into the relationship stuff, it's a complete and utter bore. And it was just dragging it down to a 5. This show is just... I'm taking one for the team and keeping up with this one, but it's almost like...
I'm not kidding, John, because your 5 is like my 2, so oh my gosh, that must be bad.
No, it's bad. I mean, they're trying. The cast is trying. And the biggest problem is, and I'll say again, that there's no chemistry between the two leads, and there's no basis for this romantic, you know, relationship that they keep trying to generate out of thin air. There's supporting characters who are getting involved with each other that have more of a basis in chemistry than the two leads do. So it just fundamentally doesn't work. But anyhow, Edmund, the next one, please.
Yeah, or, absolutely. Actually, you know this what? Is Justified season.
Okay, go ahead. No. I was going to change.
Yeah, no, I was going to say. No, I want to take Justified. Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Justified season 5, episode 11, The Toll. I love this lag. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it is.
A shooting prompts Raylan and Boyd to question their moral boundaries. And I cannot actually see what Henry gave this, but based on the reaction of my friends who love this show and keep being amazed that I don't watch it, I assume it was pretty high.
It was an 8.
If only for the exploding cigarette pack. Mm-hmm. Yes, okay.
Yes, it was an 8. For those who watch the show and want to know more about what Henry thought about it, it's one of the episodes that should be up on the VOG website as we speak. But this is starting to bring the show a little bit more in line with what we're used to. But again, this season is definitely a step down. And, the last one here, we have The 100, Season 1, Episode 2, Earth Skills. A search and rescue mission ends in surprise. Meanwhile, Raven helps Abby craft an escape pod. Oh, that only captures, what, about a quarter of the episode? Edmund, I'm curious, what would you give this? Did you see this one?
Oh, I did. I would give this an 8.
Mm-hmm. And just some general thoughts. I'll see if they align with mine as well.
Yeah, certainly I continue to be impressed with the stuff happening in orbit. The way they were playing that out with the Chancellor coming back, doing the whole vote around the table and the abstention, leading to the 10-day grace period, basically, even though they made very clear that, yes, that also means, you know, yes, another 100 people will be up for culling if you don't work this out. So the stakes can continue to be high. And even the way they were introducing the whole Raven character and as the hotshot orbital repair woman, who, of course, happens to be listening in, and it always amazes me how in TV shows everybody who's listening in always makes a big noise when they try to get away so they can be caught. But that's
it's in the script. They have
a
choice.
Yeah. But I thought she was reasonably well introduced, and certainly this whole idea of Abby having to go down to see what's actually going on and radio it back. And the other thing with that was that it actually did make sense to me, given having this control of the society, that she would be the one to finally tell them, no, they're taking the wristbands off.
Yeah.
Because everybody's so, all the people in the leadership are so used to following the rules and being in such a controlled society that you're not used to having teenagers acting out the way they normally would down on the surface, or in the regular Earth environments, they had to need someone else to tell them that no, they're taking them off because you told them to keep them on. In terms of the dynamics down on the ground, I thought it was still working reasonably well. We were having, of course, it's now become sort of the I guess the CW trope of, no, we've got teens on the ground, we have to have relationships starting and conflicts happening, and certainly the sister's protector getting strung up at the end was perhaps the part that was that I felt was playing to the CW audience a little too much, but at the same time it was still in keeping with the whole Lord of the Flies environment that they've got brewing down there.
I agree,
they were playing some lip service to, you know, yes, we've got 98 kids down there and they need to eat something, so at least we shot a saber-tooth cat sort of thing. Try and keep them alive, although I think they're going to have to get a little more organized if it's going to be at least semi-realistic in terms of what's going on the ground. So those are my general thoughts.
Yeah, one thing I will say is that I think the difference here is that, yes, you've got 100 teenagers on the ground, or, you know, 98 as the case may be, but the fact is that, okay, you've got that many teenagers on the ground who are notable because they rebelled against the society that, as you said, has been very firmly introduced as being so ingrained in the rules and regulations that just the thought of not following the rules doesn't really register with them. So you've got these kids that are nonconformists in the first place to some degree or another, and they suddenly have the ability to do everything that they wanted to do. Of course, some of them are going to hook up. What I thought was I was kind of waiting for, because I was wondering how nasty the writers were going to be, was that the girl goes chasing after the blue butterflies and then the guy comes along and they have their little moment of, kissy face. I was waiting for the blue butterflies to start biting and be like, no, we lured you into a trap.
No, you're absolutely right. I had the same thing. I was waiting for them to become toxic or something and start burning their skin.
That would have been perfect. But, you know, I get the idea that it's like, okay, you have to have some people that are having some genuine, you know, feelings for each other. You never know how they've interacted before. I like this Raven character, who seems to be someone who has always been very much on the edge of breaking the rules. And it reminded me a little bit of one of the pilots from Battlestar Galactica in terms of attitude. But, you know, in this kind of extremely regimented society, you could kind of tell that she knew where the line was and she was going right up to it, but being very careful not to step over it. Because, again, if you're over 18, it's death. That's it. There is no other, you know, recourse. And if you're under 18, you're incarcerated until you're 18. So, yeah, it's especially now that things are getting down to the wire. I love, like you said, the fact that they're having this discussion among the council of what they're going to do, and they're sitting there saying, well, we got to kill this many people in order to stay alive for the next X number of months. Oh, well, we're going to put it off 10 days. And in 10 days, the number is going to be this. It's going to go up. Because the longer you wait, these are the equations. This is the way it works.
Yeah.
And I kind of like the fact that they're taking this. You know, they're doing the opposite of Starcross. Starcross is trying to add in window dressing alien stuff, and it's not really working. But this seems to be using the teen drama stuff as window dressing for a much more grounded science fiction story that's spending far more time with the adults than I thought that they would. So I'm impressed by it. I really like it so far, and I'm hoping they can continue this balance. Because this show, I really don't know how far they're going to go with some things. I mean, they did pull back a little bit on the ground, but I have a feeling that's because they have other things in mind. But, you know, they've got 98 people on the ground, no food supplies, barely any fresh water, and an actively enigmatic group of people that apparently never left, and who knows what the heck they're looking like these days. The fact that they speared the one kid, maybe hostile. The fact that they healed the kid and apparently, at least in my mind, used the kid as bait to get food. Because I'm fairly sure those traps were for the wildlife, not for the for the other kids. I was just like, wow, that's actually pretty smart. It's like, yes, we value your life, but not enough to not use you. But at any rate, yeah, this of all the mid-season shows is really the one that I think is a winner right now. But we'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah, I just want to mention on Raven, one thing I liked was just that one little detail just to show her how she goes up to that edge. What was that little somersault into the airlock?
Yeah,
was one of the moments where it's like, you know, yeah, you like to push it, don't you? Just a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a great introduction. I mean, that tells you so much about the character in, what, 3 seconds? So, yeah, it was a nice touch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it for the quick hits this week. So, and I think we'll be wrapping this show up here, and then we will wrap up this week's content next time. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there is also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for the show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...